This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 1-888-408-6141. That's 1-888-408-6141 or tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. And we're delighted to do so on this midwinter day here in New York City. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And, we're kind of weathering the gloom here in New York pretty well. A couple of snowflakes this morning, but none the worse for wear. And bearing up against the onslaught of winter, which really hasn't been too formidable this year, except for its the long and boring duration of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so, still counting down to spring.
Exactly. All right, so remind our listeners that radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions, and we answer questions on a weekly basis here on Q&A with Layla. In the news this week, a remarkable study that suggests that ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, is on the list of neurological diseases that may be influenced by the microbiome. It's pretty amazing.
Wow.
So what we have is, beginning with anxiety and depression, we have a long succession of gut-mediated brain disorders. And then there's some studies looking at Parkinson's disease, even Alzheimer's disease. And the suggestion is that what happens in the gut doesn't stay in the gut. In the inimitable words of my great colleague, Dr. Alessio Fasano, we did a podcast on the microbiome last week or the week before, in which I talked about all the interconnections between the gut and the brain, the immune system, and so on and so on. And probably the most challenging neurological condition around is ALS.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you agree? I mean, I really hesitate to say that there's a nutritional fix for ALS. I mean, as much as we try, we may put a dent in the progression of ALS, but it's a relentless, debilitating, terminal disease that claims a lot of victims. And it's very tragic because it's not necessarily something of advanced old age. It's something that strikes individuals sometimes in the prime of life and, mysteriously robs them of all their faculties in a most debilitating way. So we need to really unlock the key to ALS. And a recent study suggests that, no, it's not so simplistic as to, take a probiotic and you'll banish it. But there is a connection between certain changes in the gut and the production of certain neurotoxic chemicals that may accelerate the progression of ALS. So it's fascinating how pervasive the influence of our gut is.
Yeah. Well, 70 to 80% of our immunity is there via GALT, gut-associated lymphoid tissue. Kind of stands to reason that the microbiome would have everything to do with our immune response in that regard. And, we also have to – a question that we get a lot is, why is there so much more autoimmunity lately than there was maybe, 100 years ago? Well, maybe 100 years ago, nobody really tracked it that well, or because lately, since the invention of antibiotics, since the invention of chemistry making our life better.
The hygiene hypothesis, or, our lack of exposure to germs, and so on and so on.
Yeah,
sterile environments.
And our toxic exposures to, herbicides, pesticides, all of that, and
GMOs, you name it, Even, you know, the vaccine theory that we may be inoculating ourselves against very serious diseases, but having exposure to certain viruses may tune up our immune system so that we don't suffer from autoimmunity. I mean, that's certainly part of...
And not to mention, okay, maybe in a lot of vaccines, they've removed the mercury, the tamarisol preservative, but so much now has been replaced with aluminum.
Right. So other
as either preservative or an adjuvant or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's still another heavy metal.
Right. On another note, a big story this week, and it was in the Wall Street Journal this morning, about... a trial of a Mediterranean diet in the treatment of depression. And what they found is that about a quarter to one-third of patients with depression, notwithstanding other forms of therapy, the two groups were identical. One group was told to eat, you know, whatever you want, and the other group was told to eat a Mediterranean diet, sort of a cleaned-up diet that's similar to our salad and salmon diet that we advocate here. Not such a radical proposition. We're not even talking like a paleo diet or, you know, SCD, no grains or no, you know, legumes, no dairy. But a diet that, you know, more whole foods, less in the way of refined sugars and artificial ingredients, had a beneficial effect on mood in these patients with depression, and that more of them achieved remission of their depression with the diet than without the diet. Of course, I mean, that's to us a big duh, right? You know, we've been doing this for years.
Our brains need those very important micronutrients, the B vitamins, magnesium, all kinds of things, amino acids, to create the neurotransmitters. When we're eating a junky diet, we're not getting that. And plus, we're hungrier eating a junky diet, and part of that is because we're not being nourished. We're just filling up on empty calories, causing destabilization of blood sugar. All of that can set up for mood disorders like anxiety and depression.
Well, you know that expression that pertains to computers, garbage in, garbage out. I guess the same thing with the brain, right?
Absolutely.
When we subsist on garbage, you know, garbage food, garbage media, you know, garbage entertainment, you know, it has a brain-addling effect, so no wonder. So, okay, let's get to our questions, because we have some interesting ones this week. We usually do them in order, but there was an interesting one this week that I want to reply to. So, it has to do
And it's a question.
Yeah.
It's a question about the latest newsletter where your article, Dr. Hoppen, was Test Your Health IQ Round 4. Now, Mike emailed us and says, I must disagree with the answer to question number 8, and we'll recite that in a moment. Doesn't the
This is a little bit like facts and alternative facts.
Yes.
Whose facts are you going to believe? Whose facts are you going to believe?
Right. Doesn't the practitioners of the New Jersey diet use nutrigenomics from DNA samples to determine the exact metabolic nature of a person for mass or weight management? And your question is number 8. For those of you who subscribe to the newsletter, it's question number 8. Which of the following most accurately reflects the state of the art of nutrigenomics, the science of using genetic information to predict an individual's optimal diet and supplementation?
Okay. And so the options are, you know, and this, I tried to make this kind of a subtle question. And so which of the following most accurately reflects the state of the art of nutrigenomics? And the choices are A, nutrigenomic information can be used to formulate diet and supplement plans with a high degree of accuracy. That's number one. Number two, blood typing is a more reliable way of determining what diet is most suitable for an individual. You know, the book by Dr. Peter D'Adamo, which is called Eat Right for Your Blood Type. So that would be B. C, while nutrigenomic information is currently of no value in predicting what a person should eat, it may be in the future as the science advances. Okay, then there's D, which is even more negative. Nutrigenomic testing will never be a useful tool for forecasting a person's optimal diet. And E is sort of a, that's a, I designed E as kind of a middle-of-the-road statement. Genetic tests, while yielding clues as to how a person should eat and supplement, must be weighed against an individual's circumstances, preferences, and health status. Now, I think what this individual's getting at, and first of all, you know, this is kind of a regional ad campaign, so people, you know, across the United States and across the world may not know what we're talking about. There's an outfit in New Jersey that, has chapters in many, towns and municipalities and boroughs in the tri-state area. It was originally called NJ Diet, but I think it's now Nouveau Diet, or maybe now it's back to NJ Diet. The name keeps changing. And they make very aggressive weight loss claims. Lose 40 pounds in 40 days is the classic claim. Sometimes more, which is a pretty aggressive claim. And I've been listening to the ads. I know nothing about what transpires when you go there, except through some feedback from some patients who felt that they lost the weight initially, but then they gained it all back and more.
Which
is the problem with these crash weight loss programs. They also said that it was a very, very calorically restricted diet. You sign a contract with them that
800 calories a day.
Yeah.
800 calories a day. Listen, you and I, my mother, everybody is going to lose weight on 800 calories a day. But the point is, it's not sustainable.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm not even speaking to that issue. That's one thing. Okay. But it's a very, they're all over the place on radio, AM radio.
Yeah.
So what I've noticed is that at first they based it on certain saliva tests and certain electrodiagnostic tests. And they didn't say anything about genetic testing. And then around, probably in the last few months, they mentioned that they were doing genetic testing to determine what a person's optimal diet would be, their eating habits, their optimal strategy for weight loss. And I thought, that's interesting. They're making the same claims, 40 pounds in 40 days, but they've added another component. And I know what that component is because I've used it, and you and I have used it at the Hoffman Center. Mm-hmm. And it does shed some light on food preferences, whether you have a fat gene or not, whether you're likely to respond to exercise or not, whether you should be on one diet or another. But when we looked at it, Layla, you and I, we just said, the science is not there yet on this. Right?
I mean, it's not rigorous at all. Yeah.
So we stopped doing it. I didn't feel it was that helpful.
And the thing is that with this particular test, it was given, the determinant, whatever was being measured there genetically, it was either given a scientific rigor of 4 stars, which is what you want, or less.
Right.
And a lot of these others
were 2 stars.
As little as 2 stars.
Right, right.
And so we couldn't put that much weight on it. And, you have to be living the lifestyle for that fat gene to become apparent, to be turned on, and so forth.
Now, it would be amazing if there was a test.
So there is the nurture argument.
It would be amazing if there was a test. I mean, look, there's this perennial question of different strokes for different folks, right? Some people respond to a vegan diet. They do great. They thrive. They feel well. Other people feel horrible. Some people really respond to a high-meat, very low-carb diet, ketogenic approach that gets them to lose scads and scads of weight, and they feel, tremendously energized. And other people feel sick and bloated from that. And so it would really be neat if we could just use a genetic test to determine, and there may be a genetic basis for this, because where people come from in the world, where they, perhaps someone of Eskimo background would do better on a very low-carb diet, eating whale blubber all the time and seal meat.
Yeah.
Whereas someone who is from ancestors are from equatorial Africa may do well on millet and sorghum and tubers, like a quasi-vegetarian diet, where they there wasn't much meat. Although, that's not perfect either, because humans are very adaptable to different circumstances, and even within one genetic pool, one season may be a season of relative deficiency of animal protein, like a famine, whereas there may be suddenly they get lucky and they get to eat a lot of game, or conversely, there may be a drought and all their vegetable products dry up and they don't get much of that. You know, so it's complicated. Right. The genetics are of food preferences and food compatibilities are very, very complicated. So what this guy is saying in this question is, he's saying, well, I don't know whether he's gone to the NJ Diet Center, I don't think he's from the NJ Diet Center. It sounds like he just hears it on the radio and he buys it uncritically that they have a method that will infallibly tell you, based on genetics, what you should be eating to optimize your health and to lose the most weight.
Right.
And the answer is, I think it's some window dressing for a program where they put you on a draconian caloric restriction program, which can get you to lose weight. You know, if you're motivated enough and if you stake your money to it.
If you don't mind being hungry, sure.
And yeah, but I mean, yeah. you make a commitment. You sign a contract that you're not going to deviate.
Right.
And they, quote, guarantee it, but they only guarantee it insofar as you strictly adhere to it.
And I think here's the gimmick, Dr. Hoffman. They say lose 40 pounds in 40 days because they know no one in their right mind is going to want to be hangry for much more than a month.
Right, right.
Or maybe 6 weeks.
Right.
Yeah. So hangry is hungry and angry.
Right, right.
For anybody that knows that term or doesn't know that term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So it's not sustainable. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe I should just.
So we use nutrigenomics insofar as the science, whether the scientific rigor is there. But it's not so much there in determining so much a person's metabolism as it is other things like, you know, the MTHFR SNP or any of those things.
Right. Well, so I'll stick with my answer.
Whether you're a fast or a slow metabolizer, right, of caffeine or something like that.
I'll stick with my answer then, which is, which of the following most accurately reflects the state of the art of nutrigenomics? E is my answer that I indicated was the correct answer, and I think it really is generally acknowledged to be the correct answer. I mean, it's not as – this question isn't as objective as, you know, what's 1 plus 1, you know, equals 2. It's my – opinion, but I think it's a generally acknowledged opinion about nutrigenomics, and that is that genetic tests, while yielding clues as to how a person should eat and supplement, must be weighed against an individual's circumstances, preference, and health status. I think that that's a very correct statement, that you take into account what's going on with the person, rather than just looking at their genes. Because, by the way, the genes, you know, we know, for example, you might have a schizophrenia gene, and you have maybe a 10% chance of developing schizophrenia. You may have a fat gene, and you have a 40% chance of being obese, but you can defy that through certain lifestyle measures. You may have a longevity gene, which you can undermine by bad lifestyle habits, or you can accentuate it. And by the way, these genes are – there's rarely a trait that isn't governed by – dozens of genes, you know, where, in fact,
that's,
you know,
true.
In talking to the developer of one of these tests, he says he uses the Watson computer, which is the most powerful computer in the world, to run some of his analysis, because they're so complex. You know, it's like plotting an equation in 20 different dimensions, which it involves a lot of computing power. And, you know, there's a lot of potential for error.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd tackle that question. It's an interesting question, and a, you know, thought-provoking question.
Mike, thank you very much for your question, and thanks for reading the newsletter. And for those of you who don't know how to get our newsletter, which is free, you go to drhoffman.com. You will be prompted to sign up for the newsletter, and you can sign up there. You can unsubscribe at any time.
Right.
All right.
And then this is, by the way, our fourth in a series of Test Your Health IQ. And we do these a couple of times a year just to kind of, give you a little challenge and
great fun,
motivate you to pursue your study of nutrition, because, I mean, we're not out to frustrate you or bust you. We just want to, you know, give you a metric by which you can gauge your understanding of important nutrition issues.
Yeah. Okay. We've got an email from Lawrence. Lawrence writes, hello, just curious if you have any protocols to eliminate lipomas, or is there any idea on what may be triggering them other than genetics, speaking of genetics?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, lipomas are little fatty blobs that develop on certain parts of the body. They may develop anywhere on the body. Sometimes they develop in the scalp, and they're concealed, but they, you know, may be a nuisance when you try to comb your hair. Or sometimes they're on more exposed parts of the body, like on the forearms. There's a genetic condition which causes a lot of lipomas to form on the upper arms. I forget the name of the syndrome. I thought it might be Gardner's syndrome, but I'm not entirely sure of that. I'd have to look it up. Whereby patients have a lot of these lipomas on their arms, and they correspondingly have a higher risk of colon cancer. It's a relatively uncommon condition, but, you know, in someone who has lots of lipomas on their arms, it might be warranted to get them an earlier colonoscopy. But that's for the most part, they're benign. They're a nuisance. Mm-hmm. They're a cosmetic embarrassment. And
are they kind of like cysts or not?
They're, well, in a sense that they're uniform. They're like cysts. Mm-hmm. They're not water-filled like certain cysts, but they're actually filled with fat, so they're called lipomas. Now, are they the result of eating too much fat? No. Is there an association between lipomas and trauma? Maybe. You know, that certain areas that are traumatized may develop a lipoma. But in terms of treating them, patients, I generally reassure patients that they're not cancer or, you know, something that's going to grow or metastasize, since they are technically a tumor, but tumors can be benign. A tumor, frankly, it's just a word that means growth. It's a growth. So they can be left alone, or they can be removed surgically. A surgeon can, you know, slice it, open it up, pull out the fatty blob, and then suture it up. It's more of a problem if that's in the scalp, because the scalp is very vascular and also more prone to infection. So more likely you'll leave that alone if it's in the scalp. It's concealed and doesn't, it's not, you know, obvious. The other proposed solution, although I haven't, don't have experience with it, some say that it works, is to use injections of phosphatidylcholine, which is phosphatidylcholine is an emulsifier. So I think
like
the idea is it's designed to sort of break it up. Maybe the body will resorb it, but I'm not sure that that's that well studied or confirmed.
Interesting. Wow. But other than that, they're not dangerous or anything like that.
No, but they cause consternation. But, you know, when you see a growth on your body, I mean, the concern is, oh, my God, you know, what is that? But there are certain areas where it's not likely to predict a bad thing. When you have a growth, say, you know, in the around the neck glands or, you know, under the arm or in the breast tissue, you know, obviously that's a concern. But if you have it over a muscle, like on your thigh or over your, you know, forearm, because of the underlying structures are less likely to have a cancer, it's less likely that they'll be dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. What about around the torso?
And around the torso, again, same thing, is that, yes, you do have your viscera underneath, but it's unlike, but also your viscera are surrounded by muscles. So, you know, say you have something around the waistline. Well, okay, you know, that's maybe close to your liver, your intestines, your stomach, but basically it's overlying some abdominal muscle, abdominal wall muscle. And that, again, is less likely to be a danger. But, you know, always check these things out with your doctor to make sure.
Yeah. Any curious let alone suspicious growth. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. But they're generally
mm-hmm. smooth, sort of globular feeling. They sort of float under your fingertips, and that's much less worrisome.
Not like a pebble.
Like an irregular or hard lump, you know, that's, mm-hmm. Or that has a granular consistency or something might be mm-hmm. more to worry about.
Yeah. More squishy than rock-like.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, well,
all right.
Generally,
Lawrence, thank you for your question.
Sure. We generally pause during our weekly Q&A with Layla, as we do with our other podcasts. So let's stipulate this is part one, and let's fast forward to part two. What's coming up for us in terms of questions?
Okay. All that's been offered for my Raynaud's syndrome is blood pressure meds. Do I have mm-hmm. to take these?
Okay. Very good question. When we return, we'll talk Raynaud's syndrome. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. Together, we offer you a weekly Q&A with Layla as part of our Intelligent Medicine series. So stay with us for part two. We'll be right back.